session number 30304.
Ted Rayner, Reel 22.
Yeah, where are we going from here?
Yeah, so after you've taken a pupil, obviously, for a kind of first flight, was there a sequence to the instruction that you would follow then?
Oh, yes. Yeah, okay. I don't remember the actual sequence as such, but obviously the things we covered had to do with the safety of the aircraft and the various types of maneuvers needed for a bombing run, low-level approaches, the use of a course and speed calculator, use of the bomb side, which of course was actually in the province of the navigator in Hudson, but had to be familiarized so far as the pilot was concerned, and single engine flying. These items were shown on a board, and we had to tick off the spaces which were indicative of what we'd covered during a particular exercise. And it included also the need for a confident approach, or I mustn't use the word approach in a different sense. We're not in the air at the moment. To be able to make a confident attempt at going round again if it's for some reason the actual landing didn't occur in the way that you expected or didn't occur at all. And I'm speaking now, of course, from the pupil's point of view. He had to be able, once he went solo, to be able to decide during the last 20 feet off the ground, as it were, whether this is going to be a reasonable landing or whether for some reason he ought to say, no, I better go around again. So obviously it was necessary to make quite sure that he was confident in being able to do that. What I haven't, of course, yet mentioned, but which would come at a convenient point when the pupil demonstrated sufficient confidence in the various maneuvers, particularly in regard to safety and particularly in regard to landing, he would be sent off solo. This was probably the most nail-biting, not that I did that sort of thing, but it's a simple way to put it, part of the instructor's job with any particular pupil. And it was a very pleasant event if he made a good approach and landing. You felt you'd really done something worthwhile. Yes, so it would be necessary for the instructor to be satisfied that as these columns which represented achievements on the part of the pupil pilot, he'd successfully completed them when he would be recognized as ready to go across to the operational training side of the training program at Silloth and crew up with the necessary navigator and two wireless operator air gunners. And from then, basically one can say that I think that most operational training units, there was a division between the actual teaching of the way to fly the aircraft under all circumstances and the way that the aircraft was to be used when the other members of the crew joined it for actual operational procedures such as night operations, bomb dropping, gunnery work, and so on.
Were there any occasions when you were with a pupil that the pupil made you as an instructor nervous of their abilities, or was it all, were they all of a certain standard that didn't really occur?
No, they weren't. They weren't by any means all at a certain standard. I think one of the key factors had to be judging what standard they were at when you first started to work with them. And there were several examples I can think of where there were things that needed to be put right. I think it would be fair to say that I perhaps was overconfident. I may well have been. When you're young, you get that way sometimes. But I was always happy about the fact that the pupil made a mess of something. I could get it right. The only time, actually, I have... Well, this is rather funny, because it wasn't actually me. I did feel a little nervous, I suppose, on one occasion. This was much later when I was in Iceland, and towards the end of my tour there, I was given the job of giving what was called a Czech duel to one or two people, including one wing commander in particular, I remember, who was due to take over a Hudson squadron. I'm glad it wasn't the one that I was in, or had been in, or would be likely to be in. But of course, by then, I'd got that much more experience on them. This was August 1943, I think. And this chap, we had to take them with at least one normal crew member, and I took my wireless operator Jackie Noble up with us, and the landing that this chap gave us was about the worst I've experienced. We managed to get it down eventually. Well, I did, I suppose. But Jackie was absolutely shattered, and in correspondence later, because for a time I did correspond with the ex-chaps, and the way he described his feelings to one of the other fellows came to me from this third person. Well, if there had to be an occasion when it was a bit scary, that was it.
What were the kind of common mistakes that the pupils would make when you were instructing?
The most difficult part of landing is to know the height that you have the aircraft at, going over the runway, as it were, just above the runway. It comes to some people quite easily and readily. Others find it difficult. So I think most of them had a bit of a problem, which lasted, it was obvious, to the time when they were in the actual operational training department across the airfield. But there were times when they, let's make it individual, when one of our pupils we passed on was flying, coming into land in an aircraft that belonged to the operation, so we knew it wasn't one of the primary training section. And we make a landing that would evoke the remark from the instructor who had had him in the early part of his training, "Oh, that would be so-and-so." We did come to know them in that respect. But that was the most difficult part, I think, most of the pupil pilots came across. And it is a tricky business. It's all very well nowadays. I mean, these airliners seem to settle themselves, more or less. And you don't get all that much of a vertical view. Well, you don't get any vertical view, actually, but I mean something, anything like looking down straight rather than obliquely. So it's known as feeling for it. You're feeling for, I don't know what, because once the wheels touch, of course, you know where you are. Then, of course, if you haven't judged it correctly, and I think one has to bear in mind the fact that the Hudson was designed as an up-and-coming American, they call it an airliner, but we wouldn't call it that these days. But it didn't really land happily in what we call the three-point position. That is, the two front wheels and the tail wheel down at the same time, you can't expect the tail wheel always to be down on any aircraft every time, but with the tail wheel only hovering, as it were, above the runway. And the Hudson had been designed, I think, by designers who were foreseeing the advent of the tricycle undercarriage. The tricycle meaning, of course, a landing wheel at the front of the aircraft and then the two wheels or the multiple wheels as the main weight-carrying part in the landing. So it was really a matter of striking an in-between attitude between the Hudson, which would have been a lovely aircraft to land had it had a tricycle undercarriage, and the tail wheel sort of hanging 2 or 3 feet above the runway. That was really its best attitude. But of course, in order to get the full value of steering it, once it was on the runway, you really did need to get the tail down, and also you could lock the tail wheel. Not really a good idea if you were still swinging around on the runway, but anyway, the 3-point landing was still considered to be the best that could be done in a Hudson.
Now, during this period as well, I think you were commissioned, weren't you?
I beg your pardon?
You were commissioned during this period.
Where are we? Yeah, the 18th of March, I can give you the actual day. 18th of March, 1942, yes. Yeah.
Was there a process involved in being commissioned from an NCO to an officer? What's the kind of sequence that occurs there?
I think it must be obvious that the commissioning board are well aware of the career of a potential officer. What actually happens, I don't have any idea in those terms. One just supposes that there's been a recommendation. I felt, as did many of my colleagues at that time, we were perfectly happy as we were, but we knew that time was passing. The war would be fought in different ways, with different equipment, as the improvements came along. We were not likely to stay together throughout the whole of the war. We had, as sergeants, of course, time committed promotions to flight sergeant and then to warrant officer. That was the highest non-commissioned rank. But although Johnny Lane, the most experienced probably pilot amongst the group I was with, because he had flown quite a lot pre-war in the Volunteer Reserve on things like Hawker Hearts, and which he used to like, I think, almost as much as the Hudson, or perhaps more. But anyway, he opted to wait a little longer and became a warrant officer before applying for a commission. So all that we decided to do, more or less, well, 3 or 4 of us anyway, was simply to go to the adjutant and say that we'd like to be considered for a commission. I was given a date to go before the commissioning board, and these were held at various places where there was a large influx and movement of RAF personnel, at Blackpool, for instance, because that was an aircrew intake place of, I forget the actual designation, and the commissioning board was to be held there on the 18th of March, and so I was at Silloth at that time that there was an aircraft due for air tests, so somebody said probably it's probably Hodgkinson, I suppose. You might as well take this aircraft down to Blackpool to go board. So I did, and just went. Amongst with other people, they were sitting in a room, various types, some sergeants, some flight sergeants, some other air crew, other than pilot, I mean, some wingless wonders, as they were known, about half an hour, I think it probably took, more or less question and answer, and then I was told I would be commissioned as a pilot officer, and better get back to Sylhet.
The question that they're asking you, did it relate to what you'd done to that period? Was it your career to date, really? Or was there anything else that they...
No, it was broader than that. I think there was a certain peering into the type of person you were. I think it was a very abbreviated business compared with pre-war, or for even for a short service commission pre-war. I'm quite sure it was... I don't remember having to get any recommendations or anything of that kind, any testimonials, nor do I remember whether they were needed when I enlisted in the Volunteer Reserve. I had, of course, as most people had, a CV, if you like, but I can't honestly remember any specific questions that I was asked. So I was just waiting for the end of it, I suppose. Is it a yes or no?
To a certain extent, by making the application, though, and that being accepted as an application by your commanding officer, in a sense, was that almost enough in the sense of not needing the testimonials because you've made that approach?
Well, I imagine that there were certain applications made which were not forwarded. I don't know. I do know that... there were one or two cases. In fact, I think I've mentioned Jackie Noble, my wireless operator on 269. It was suggested to him by his flight commander that he ought to retrain as a pilot. This was earlier in his career. He said he was a boy entrant pre-war, and he said, no, I want to serve my time as a non-commissioned officer and get the pension and so on. You see, he had a different viewpoint. He'd started a family by then. He was still guaranteed a job, as it were, by virtue of his type of entry after the war. Whereas we knew that there would be a need to apply for a permanent commission if we or anyone else took a commission during the war. If it was a wartime commission, it was only temporary.
As you said, when you went down there, you were air testing a Hudson as well at the same time. When you did that, would you fly down on your own?
Oh, yes.
So there would be no other crew member?
Oh, no.
Did you fly directly back to Sylhet?
No. I knew Blackpool quite well, and I knew certain landmarks separating my home, as it was before the war, in Rossendale, from Blackpool, a matter of 40 miles, and it wasn't very far off the track that I could take if I had to make a wide sweep to go back to Silla. So I thought, well, I might just as well have a look of what it looks like from 2,000 feet or whatever. So I did. I just had a look and recognised several places, including the grammar school I'd attended, and flew past at a suitable height so that they could see me. And as it happened, I was told, I don't know whether it was absolutely true or not, but I was told that this was a prelude to Wings for Victory Week, which was to follow. It was quite a pleasant occasion to be able to do that. But I had to be back at Silloth in time for night flying, so I didn't dilly-dally too long.
What changes occur when you move from, I take it you've moved from the sergeant's mess to the officer's mess?
On a training station, which was a wartime station, really, the difference in accommodation was very, very small, provided there was sufficient room for you in the officer's mess. In my case, there wasn't, nor was there in the case of my colleague who was commissioned at the same time. But there were very kind landladies in a row of houses, and there were others, I suppose, although we were fortunate not to have to go to the Hydro Hotel again, which is where we were when we were under training. But they were very generous people and looked after us very well. So it was a matter, really, of dining. Certainly depended really whether we were on day flying or night flying, because of course all the things we did, apart from those which needed acute visual sense, such as low-level flying and bombing runs and so on. Apart from night flying, when we would not have the usual daytime meals in the mess on the station, our landladies cooked us up a remarkable breakfast, considering that there was rationing at the time. Of course, they got a certain amount of ration book, whatever, coupons or whatever they were, but certainly nothing like the plates full of bacon and Cumberland sausage and fried bread and potato and eggs. They really were wonderful people, Mrs. Todd and her neighbour. Of course, we were in the mess for relaxation, but we certainly were fortunate to bed down in very comfortable beds in these lodgings